Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Tea and Murder, part book club, part interview show, all Agatha Christie. I'm your host, Rebecca Tundy Norman. I am so excited to have here with me today Kemper Donovan. Kemper is the host of All About Agatha, the podcast on Agatha Christie, of course, and author of an upcoming mystery series, The Ghostwriter Series. All About Agatha was co-founded with Catherine Brobeck, who sadly passed away just over a year ago. And I know it's important to you, Kemper, that we recognize her when we're talking about the podcast. So we just wanted to say that. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be on another Agatha Christie-focused podcast. I feel like I'm at home.
Yeah. Is this your first time on another Agatha Christie podcast, or is this something you do fairly frequently?
You know, there aren't as many Agatha yeah. Christie-centric podcasts as you think there would be, since there are approximately 3 billion podcasts out there at this point in time.
And 3 billion Agatha Christie books.
Yes, there are certainly 3 billion readers. there is a fabulous podcast, which I'll just go ahead and shout out right at the top of this episode, besides mine, which is She Done It, hosted by Caroline Crampton. And she looks at not just Agatha Christie, but a lot of different writers from the golden age of detective fiction. But there's a lot of Christie on that podcast. And it's a really, really fabulous, well-researched, well-produced podcast. So if anyone listening to this has not yet listened to She Done It, I very much encourage you to do so.
Absolutely. And seconded for sure. So it's I definitely agree with you there. And, but you're right. It's like, it's weird for how popular Agatha Christie is that, you know, there aren't that many podcasts out there on her work. But tell me a little bit about, we'll talk a little bit about how you came to the podcast, your podcast, but how did you come to Agatha Christie in your readership of her?
I think I came to Christie the way many people came to Christie when I was a child.
Yeah.
And I was an avid reader. And I actually remember this moment, which is one that other people, I think, share. I was obsessed with Greek mythology when I was in and around fourth grade. And simultaneous with that Greek mythology obsession, I also started devouring Agatha Christie novels. And I actually think that those two things are related. Mm. Now, having done this Agatha Christie podcast for 6 years, I think there are so many different reasons why Agatha Christie is as popular as she is and as enduring as she is. But I think that some of her books are written on an almost elemental level in the same way that myths are. They're fairy tale-like and mythology-like. So in the same way that children respond to fairy tales and to mythology, I also responded to Agatha Christie when I was 9 years old. And she just became a sort of building block of for my love of literature in general and bridged me over into adult fiction. Because Christie herself did not consider that she was writing children's fiction. She hated when people said that she wrote for children, so she didn't. I think it's just that a lot of people come to her early on, and that's part of the reason why she's so beloved. And now I can, you know, I can and I will continue to read her for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And that rest of your life has led to the All About Agatha podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about like the format of the podcast and how you started it with Catherine?
Sure. So I knew Catherine through my husband, actually. She and my husband went to college together. So they knew each other for many, many years. And we all lived in Los Angeles. And this was in 2016 that we were having dinner one night. And at that point in 2016, there were a lot of podcasts, not as many as there are now, but it was it was a format that was becoming popular. Yeah. And somehow we got onto the conversation of podcasting. And my husband and I both said, Catherine, you need to host a podcast, because she was always just a very audacious and outspoken and smart person whose opinions were unpredictable. Like, she was one of those people where I couldn't always tell what her reaction to a book or to a piece of news, you know, a current event would be. And there are very few people like that, actually. And I just remember saying, Catherine, you're so interesting. She also has a very distinctive voice. And I said, you need to host a podcast. And she was like, I wouldn't really want to do that alone. Maybe I could do it, you know, with someone else. Maybe we could do one. And we had always shared a love, particularly of the Poirot series starring David Suchet, which adapted all of the Poirot stories of Agatha Christie's. And once we started talking about, oh, maybe the two of us should do a podcast, it didn't take us long to figure out that we should do one all about Agatha Christie.
That's so fun. And in terms of the format, how did you come up with that? Because it's a very specific format for how you rank the books.
Yes. So we decided before we started it that we would have a structure. Mm-hmm. And the structure is basically that we went through every single book of Agatha Christie's in publication order. So starting with The Mysterious Affair at Styles and ending with, well, we actually went a little bit out of publication order at the very end of the podcast. So we should have ended with Sleeping Murder, but we actually ended with Curtain.
Mm-hmm. Which is a great way
It is. Well, and that was Catherine's argument. Actually, Catherine and I had a long-standing argument about whether or not we should stick with publication order. And I am a pedant at heart. So I was like, we have to do this the way we've been doing it. Sleeping Murder was the last one to be published. So with Sleeping Murder, we must end. And she was like, no, Curtain is like a fabulous ending for the podcast. Mm-hmm. So anyway, in addition to going through all of her books in publication order, we also decided to rank them. So this was, you know, meant to be a very detail-oriented, granular, nerdy kind of an endeavor from the very beginning, and it very much was. And after kind of discussing the book in an episode, the final part of the episode would basically be the rankings portion, where we would go through six different categories: plot mechanics, plot credibility, series-long characters, so usually detectives and other characters surrounding the detective, mm-hmm. book-specific characters, setting and tone, which is a bit of a catch-all category for readability and just how much we liked the book.
Yeah.
And then our final category was to do with depictions stuck in their time, which is kind of the phenomenon of reading Agatha Christie decades and decades after she wrote many of these books, mm-hmm. and sometimes the jarring effect of the way that she wrote about certain aspects of humanity. We felt that it was very important to address that issue, because that's something that I think everyone grapples with in very different ways when they read Agatha Christie, with very different responses. So we incorporated that as well and assigned number values to all six of those categories. And in that way came up with an overall score, and were able to rank all of the books as we went through the canon. And as you already referenced, Catherine did very tragically pass away at the end of 2021. We had done 60 of the 66 books at that point.
Wow.
So for the last six books, I was fortunate enough to have co-hosts come on and discuss the book and do the rankings with me, because at that point, Catherine and I had really built a community of not just listeners to the podcast, but Agatha Christie scholars and authors who loved Agatha Christie. And they really came to my rescue and helped me. And the final book, Curtain, which was, you know, Catherine won that argument. I felt like I had to, quote unquote, let her win that argument since she was no longer here to plead her case.
I also think she's right, to be honest.
You know what? The funny thing is, I know she's right after having done it. And mea culpa, like, she was totally right. But yeah. Curtain was co-hosted by her mother, actually, Linda Brobeck. And that was, you know, I don't even want to call it a full circle moment. It was just a very emotional thing to do. And I think it was, I know it was helpful for me. And I hope that it was helpful for Linda. I believe it was. And also a lot of listeners, you know, about a year after she passed away, to be able to hear from her mother and see how her family is doing. And they're still very much mourning. And I'm still very much mourning. And will be forever. And I think it's a secondary sort of purpose of the podcast now post Catherine has been to honor her and her memory. And just, I think also the idea that when we lose people, they don't go away and we don't have to stop talking about them.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, I mean, Agatha Christie's novels are obviously, you know, in a way, in a very specific way, focused on death. And this is a very different experience of death and interaction with death in my personal life with Catherine. But that contrast, I think, has also been illuminating and something that I've talked about in the wake of her passing.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. And, you know, having listened to the podcast for this specific episode, the book we'll be talking about, which is Secret of Chimneys, and Catherine was obviously hosting with you on that episode, she had such a great way of talking about books. And she was so personable in how she talked about the book, but had such a strong opinion. And as you said, often you two didn't always have the same opinion. And I just love listening to her and you together. So it's really great to hear you talk about her that way. And I'm sure your community really appreciates it. I'm interested a little bit in the community you talk about, because I'm just kind of starting out into this podcasting world and into the Agatha Christie universe specifically. And I'm wondering if you were you an Agatha Christie expert when you started, or were you just a fan who was kind of then moving more into knowing more as you read more and more?
The honest answer is that I thought I was an Agatha Christie expert. I think I had the hubris of actually thinking I knew a lot about her. Uh-huh. But now that I know a lot more, speaking with a lot of hubris in the present as well, but I do think that I've put in the time to earn that, to say that I know a lot more.
Yeah.
But I knew so little. So I would say that I was, a casual fan, but an ardent fan, nonetheless, of Christie. I had pretty much read everything by her. There were, to be honest, a couple of books as I was covering them for the podcast where I was like, have I read this before? Because I thought I read every single one of Christie's 66 books, but maybe I didn't read this one, or, you know, I could have forgotten it. There are so many. But I had pretty much read everything by her, but I had not thought as deeply about the way that she structures her puzzles and her thrillers, which we'll be talking about.
Yeah.
And I think the, you know, her craft. I had not thought about her craft. And also, I didn't know that much about her biography. And that's something else that I've tried to bring to the podcast as well. You know, the ways in which Christie's own experiences can shed light on what she was writing about. Because she had a really interesting life.
She did.
And so I think I've learned a lot in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. I feel similarly. And again, I've only been doing this for, you know, I've been an Agatha Christie reader and fan for a very long time. And I would have considered myself a person who was an expert on her books, in the sense that I haven't just read them once or twice, but many of them, like, you know, in the tens of times. And, but as you say, the more you kind of do this and do the talking and interview experts who have different perspectives and different areas of expertise, you realize how little you know, or I realized how little I know. I should point that finger back at myself. And that's been a really both wonderful and humbling experience to get to learn so much more about something I thought I knew a lot about.
And isn't that the way with everything? Mm-hmm. I think it's you don't really start learning about something until you realize how little you know.
Yeah.
About it. Yeah.
That's right. And there's even little things where now I, you know, in episodes that we've already recorded, I think I remember I said something on Death on the Nile about I thought that Agatha Christie made Poirot seasick as a way to annoy him. But it turns out that she was actually a person who got terribly seasick. So it was like a connection point. So that for me, when I read that in one of the biographies I was then reading, I thought, oh, I got that totally wrong, you know? And I just love moments like that where I don't know, you just, it unlocks something else in your knowledge.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you have written or are writing mystery books of your own. Are you Christie influenced? Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the great things about doing the podcast is that we do pepper, our episodes with interviews with contemporary mystery authors.
Yeah.
And I almost feel like any author who writes mysteries who says they're not influenced by Christie has to
liars.
Be lying.
They're liars.
Right? Because again, she's so fundamental to the genre.
Yeah.
You know, at this point, she's inescapable.
Yeah.
I think, and undeniable as an influence, love her or hate her. And most people love her, or at least love some aspect of her.
Yeah.
Or certain aspects of her. So that's been great too, you know, to interview people like Tana French, who loves Agatha Christie.
Yeah.
And Sophie Hanna, who we've had on many times, and who I believe you also spoke
that's
with.
Right. Yeah. We talked about Evil Under the Sun with Sophie. So that's a great episode.
Oh, Sophie loves Evil
yeah,
Under
she
the
does.
Sun.
She loves it.
She thinks that we rated Evil Under the Sun way too low. She's very annoyed with,
I know.
That, with where
talk,
Evil Under the Sun
all
is
about
in
it.
Our ranking.
Yeah.
I love Evil Under the Sun too. Anyway, but yeah, it's, so I was undoubtedly, I think I would have been influenced by Christie even if I had tried to write a mystery that had nothing to do with an Agatha Christie mystery or didn't resemble a Christie mystery,
yeah.
but actually very intentionally tried to write a Christie-like mystery as well. And I used some of her tricks almost as, an inside joke sort of a thing that I think any listener of my podcast, my and Catherine's podcast, it feels very strange to say my podcast,
yeah.
but then it also feels strange to say our podcast. So I find that awkward. Just want to point that out. But I think any listeners of the podcast will be able to pick up on them and hopefully get a little chuckle from some of the Christie tropes that I've thrown in there. And I absolutely love Agatha Christie. And I had actually written a novel prior to doing the All About Agatha podcast.
Right.
And it has some elements of suspense, but it's not a mystery. And I was writing a second novel during the first year or two of the podcast. And it's very cliched to have a hard time writing your sophomore novel because, the magic of getting your first novel published has worn off. And now you feel like you have to do it all over again. And I had just, I went through all of the, I think, usual trials and tribulations that an author does writing a second novel. And finally, I turned around after banging my head against a wall with this other manuscript and realized I put in so many hours a week talking about researching, reading, analyzing Agatha Christie. Why don't I just write a mystery?
Yeah.
And it really hadn't occurred to me. It took years for this to occur
to
me. And it wouldn't have occurred to me if I hadn't done the podcast.
Right.
And I'm not going to say that writing this mystery was easy, because writing's never easy. That's another thing. Anyone who's like, oh, it just flowed out of me. It's like, no, you're a liar.
If it flowed out of you, you might want to shove it back in, buddy. Like, it probably wasn't that good.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Might want to take a second look at it.
Yeah.
I think that it made sense. There was a sort of organic quality to writing this mystery where I was like, oh, okay, this feels like what I should be doing now. And and then I was able to, I was lucky enough to find a publisher. The whole journey was a slog, but there was a lot of joy in it. And that is really all due to Agatha Christie.
That's so fantastic. Can you tell us anything about like release dates or anything like that, or not yet?
So it will be published in February of 2024.
Okay.
So about a year from now. Yeah, kind of a long window. The publisher is Kensington, who publish a lot of mysteries, especially in the U.S. And I'm hoping that it will be, I'll be able to get in other territories, especially the UK, since unsurprisingly there, you know, the podcast has a lot of listeners in the UK. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's, I'm very excited for that rollout. And, you know, I think between then and now, it's just going to be about figuring out promotion and all of that. I mean, there's a whole, you know, machine behind the publishing industry, which is something that Agatha Christie dealt with. And one of the reasons why her letters to her longtime agent, Edmund Cork, are as entertaining as they are, because she was often very displeased with things that were going on surrounding the publication of her book. She had a lot of opinions, and she was an astute businesswoman when it came to her own career.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations. I can't wait for February 2024. That's very exciting.
Thank you.
And so I think it's a good time to dive into the book we're going to talk about today, which is, unfortunately, The Secret of Chimneys. I know. I am extremely pissed at you for choosing this book, but we're still going to talk about it. So I'm just going to give a little brief historical note to put it in its place, which is anywhere but here. So The Secret of Chimneys was published in 1925, right after The Man in the Brown Suit and Poirot Investigates, and before The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. It is a standalone adventure thriller mystery novel, and the first time we meet Superintendent Battle. Battle goes on to appear in a number of other books, including The Seven Dials Mystery, which is also a standalone, and other Poirots, including Cards on the Table, Murder is Easy, and Towards Zero. He's also mentioned in Mrs. McGinty's Dead, and he's alluded to in The Clocks as the father of Colin Lamb. So he is definitely a recurring character in the Poirot universe in the way of, you know, Hastings, Jap, George, or Miss Lemon. The Secret of Chimneys was pretty favorably reviewed at the time that it came out, much to my surprise, but more recently is not considered one of Christie's best works. Christie historian Dr. John Curran, who also joined us on this podcast, calls it, quote, enjoyable but preposterous, which I think is a very generous interpretation of it, actually. It's generally considered to be one of the best of Christie's early thrillers, which is kind of damning with faint praise. And I personally do not like this book, if you can't tell, but let's dive into it. Kemper, would you like to give us a brief, like, 1 minute or so synopsis of The Secret of Chimneys?
I would. All right, here goes. This is hard because The Secret of Chimneys is
very complicated.
Yes, a tortuous, if not torturous book. All right, so The Secret of Chimneys is an early thriller of Agatha Christie's in which a whole heck of a lot of stuff happens. Too much stuff, you might say.
Too much.
If I'm being kind, I'd call it a picaresque romp inspired by Anthony Hope's The Prisoner of Zenda, mm-hmm. which was a novel Christie loved very much from her childhood. In Christie's book, the fictional hero Anthony Cade, see what she did there, becomes embroiled in a mystery that involves two murders, two impersonations, two top secret written documents, and a healthy dose of romance. And without getting too specific so as to avoid spoilers, by the end of the book, two of the large cast of characters inhabiting the titular country estate of Chimneys have been proven guilty of the murders, as well as a jewel heist thrown in for good measure, while another two characters have been crowned king and queen of Herzoslovakia.
Herzoslovakia.
Which is a fake... Ah, yes. It's a fake Eastern European country dreamed up by Christie. Mm-hmm. I also feel the need to add that there is a lot of unfortunate xenophobia and anti-Semitism
Correct.
Peppered throughout the story, usually in a misguided attempt at humor, which for me was by far its most problematic aspect.
Yeah, I agree.
Is my attempt to summarize The Secret of Chimneys.
That was, you know, you actually made it sound kind of interesting from there. But yes, that's exactly what happened. It's a lot of stuff. It's a lot of... adventure-y type of stuff. There's a lot of pluck, which, as I've said before, I hate pluck. Can't stand it. But so you chose this book for us to read because I asked the guests to choose the book. So you did this to us. You chose it because you rated it the second lowest on your podcast. So you kind of wanted to give it a rereading and another chance. What did you hope to find with a rereading?
So you're right. I chose to read this book. I brought this upon myself and you. I am so sorry. because Catherine and I read this book quite early on in the podcast, since it is her, I believe, fifth book. It's very, very early on.
Very early,
in the canon. And when we read it, we still weren't even sure if the podcast was going to continue, because especially in the beginning, I'm sure you can relate to this, even just the technical, you know, the technicalities of doing a podcast were taking so much time and it was so overwhelming. We were like, oh my God, are we really going to review all 66 of Christie's books? I had just had a baby. Like, it was madness. And we were very grumpy reading this book. Because it's not one of Christie's best. And I think that uncertainty filtered through in our review of the book on the podcast. It's definitely one of our more negative reviews, deservedly so. I mean, so I have now reread this book after having covered all 66 of Christie's books. The only book that was ranked lower is Postern of Fate, which is fairly universally recognized among Christie fans to be her worst book.
Yeah.
According to John Curran, it shouldn't have even been published. It's a travesty that it was published.
Oh, no.
I wanted to read it because it had become a running joke that Catherine and I were going to reread it when we were done, because we would get so many responses from listeners saying, no, 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 The Secret of Chimneys is not as bad as you think it is. You have to read it again. You weren't fair to it. Please, please, please reread The Secret of Chimneys. It was shocking how many times this happened. The only other book that got as much pleading was Death Comes as the End, which is her book set in ancient Egypt. We ranked that really low. I'm also going to have to revisit that one, much to my chagrin. But we wanted to start with this one since it is ranked second to lowest. And I have to say, I was hoping to get a slightly sunnier perspective on it. And in some ways, I did. I think it is preposterous. And it's definitely not even one of her best thrillers. I think that The Man in the Brown Suit, which she published just before this book, is a much better thriller. And I think in some ways, in a lot of ways, The Secret of Chimneys feels like a retread of The Man in the Brown Suit, and one that's not done as well as the one that she had just put out.
Yeah, I agree.
So it's derivative. I mean, it's derivative of The Prisoner of Zenda.
Yeah.
It's derivative of The Man in the Brown Suit. And then I think she would go on even with Why Didn't They Ask Evans, which is another thriller that I revisited by way of the Hugh Laurie adaptation that came out recently.
Right.
And realized that we had been too harsh on that thriller as well. Okay. I think that one is definitely better than The Secret of Chimneys.
One. Yeah.
I think most of the thrillers are actually better than The Secret of Chimneys. But there are probably a couple of other books that don't function as well that she wrote later on in her career. Certainly Postern of Fate, and I think even Passenger to Frankfurt and Elephants Can Remember. Mm-hmm. Those are all books that, you know, she was writing in sort of the sunset of her career. Mm-hmm. We could get into the whole, you know, were her own mental faculties failing at that point? Some people theorize that they were, but that is certainly not happening in The Secret of Chimneys. I think what you see in The Secret of Chimneys is someone who's fine tuning and honing her craft and figuring out what she writes well. I'm actually cribbing that from this scholar, Allison Light, who was one of my most exciting interviews that I had on the podcast. She is this literary critic who wrote about Agatha Christie in 1990, or it might have even been 89. It was either in the late 80s or early 90s. Mm-hmm. And she's one of the first people, one of the first serious scholars to take Christie seriously and to write about her. And she talks about how, you know, Christie was a modernist. She actually was. And something that all modernists writing in the early 20th century had to do was to figure out their craft and to experiment.
Yes.
I mean, that's what modernists did. They experimented. And I think that these 20s thrillers, she's taking a genre that was incredibly popular because she did always want to make money as well. Mm-hmm. She always had an eye on commerciality when she was writing. Mm-hmm. And she was trying her hand at it. And I think that The Secret of Chimneys makes a lot more sense within the context of the books being published when it was published in the mid 20s. And it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for a lot of different reasons reading it in 2023, you know, almost literally 100 years later. Yeah. There are all the depictions stuck in their time, which I think kind of speak for themselves.
Yes.
But I think that the pluck and the madcap kind of rompy atmosphere, it's so forced.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
I think that that would have been less blatant if you were reading it in 1925, because there were so many other books similar to it. That, I mean, that's not really a compliment, right? I'm basically saying that it was so derivative that it would have at least fit into its place better when it was published, you know, in a contemporary setting than it does now. Yeah. But I think that there are actually, there are a lot of tricks that you can see her using in this book that she would then go on to use. You know, we have the notion of never underestimate the help.
Yeah.
She actually uses that in two different ways in this book. She has a really clever double bluff motif as to who this shadowy person, King Victor, is. Mm-hmm. She always, in these thrillers, there has to be someone who's unmasked at the end of the book, you know, in The Secret of Adversary. In The Secret Adversary, it's Mr. Brown. Mm-hmm. And then here it's King Victor. Right. And, you know, the tricks that she uses, I think, to obfuscate who King Victor is are very clever, and we can see them using her to much greater effect very soon after. I mean, and it's so significant that she wrote The Secret of Chimneys, and the very next year, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd came out. I mean, it's one of her best books. I mean, it's one of the best mysteries ever written. It's, you know, we rank it at number three among all of her books. Some people rank it at number one, and I would support that. It's brilliant. It is absolutely a brilliant conception, but also, most importantly, a brilliant execution of that concept.
Yeah,
so I think you can see her figuring out what she's good at and figuring her way through this whole writing thing that was still fairly new to her in this book. And that's fascinating. So I think if you read it in that spirit, you might actually get some more appreciation out of it, certainly than I did on my my first reread. My re-reread was a lot better than my reread.
No, I completely agree. And I actually have always found it interesting that Chimneys came out after The Man in the Brown Suit, because The Man in the Brown Suit and Chimneys are not only stylistically, but also plot-wise, very similar. And I don't particularly like The Man in the Brown Suit for a lot of reasons, but it's a much more enjoyable book, and it's a much better book, in my opinion. And so for me, that was all, it's interesting because, as you say, one of the great things about Christie is she wrote so many books that you can, when you read them, you can actually kind of track the way that she is figuring out who she is as a writer. And for me, it's very interesting that the one, like I would have expected the other to come first, you know, Chimneys to come first and then Man in the Brown Suit, because it's such a kind of more elevated version of this, basically the same plot. But I agree with you. I think I always toggle back and forth because I want to talk about Christie's work as a whole. And I, you know, you have to read everything, but I also feel like we can just not like things. Like we can just be like, well, I just didn't like it and I don't want to have to go back to it. And that's, for example, how I feel about like all the Tommy and Tuppence books. I like simply don't reread them. It's actually also how I feel about like, And Then There Were None. I never reread it. I reread it for this podcast and hadn't reread it in years. And I know you ranked it as number two, and I know that people consider it one of her best works. And I, you know, I understand in terms of like the structure of it. It's a brilliant book. I just don't enjoy reading it for whatever reasons. For I can, you know, we can get into it, but that's a different podcast. So I always toggle between these two things of kind of diving into it for its the literary value of, you know, exploring her work, and then also being like, well, I'm allowed to just not like this. Where do you sit within that? Because you really had to read every single one and then rank them.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
That's why Christy, I think, lends herself to a ranking experiment like what Catherine and I did, because she's a writer who is brilliant. She's a genius.
She is.
You know, that's the ultimate answer. I mean, it's so funny when people say, like, why is Christy so popular? And, you know, well, because she's a genius, right? I mean, she had to have been to write as many brilliant books as she did. But then she wrote books that weren't brilliant. And of course, this is all subjective. And that's too, you know, we're trying to impose objectivity here on something that's inherently subjective.
Right.
But I think most people who have read Christy widely have books where they say, oh my God, this is one of my favorite books. This is, you know, I love this more than I ever expected to love a mystery, mm-hmm. right? It's like one of their favorite mysteries. And then other books where they're like, what?
Right.
What was that about? Right. And that's so fascinating. And there aren't a lot of authors that are like that. Most authors, you're either like, pretty much like everything they did, or pretty much don't like everything they did. But to have that range as she really does, because she wrote as much as she did, is fascinating, which is why it's so interesting that the same author wrote The Secret of Chimneys, and then, you know, a year later, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd was published, at least. That's one of the other things I've learned after doing this podcast for as long as I have. Published and write, you know, the writing of a manuscript and the publication of that manuscript are sometimes in no way have, you know, the one anything to do with the other, because she was such a fast writer, and especially in the 20s and the 30s, she published sometimes three books in a year. It's very unclear, because her notes are a bit of a mess. That's what John Curran, you know, did to brilliant effect in his Agatha Christie Secret Notebooks. He tried to work out as much as he could, you know, when she was doing what she was doing, but it's always unclear when exactly she was writing, but even so, it had to have been pretty close together, right? And the fact that she could do The Secret of Chimneys and then do The Murder of Roger Ackroyd is just so interesting. And I think contrasting the two of them and contrasting all of these different books, you actually gain a greater appreciation for the brilliant ones also. And that's certainly has happened. I mean, I would say, And Then There Were None, I think it makes sense that you don't like it as much, because it's a very un-Christie-like book. It's not very Agatha Christie-ish. There's a starkness, a brutality to that book that is a nihilism, basically, to that book that is unlike anything else she wrote. And that's part of why it's so powerful, because if you read that book within the context of everything else, you're like, oh my God,
she was mad.
Where did this come from? You know, like, how did you do this? It's shocking that she was able to pull that off.
Stuart Turton, who was the first episode of this podcast, had a theory. That was the book he chose. And his theory about it was that, it was Christie's way of doing like an evil version of all of her main characters. So like Emily Brent is an evil Miss Marple, Justice Wargrave is an evil Poirot, et cetera, et cetera. You can kind of find what Anthony Mardson is an evil Hastings. And he like really made the case for it. And I'd never thought of it that way, but I thought it was pretty brilliant.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. The other thing I'll say, and it's just a slight quibble with something you said earlier, which someone, I'm basically heading off the past someone contacting you, as I have been contacted so many, many times for any minor inaccuracies and things like that on the podcast. This is the first Superintendent Battle book.
Yes.
And actually, that's something I also appreciated even more reading it for this episode. But Battle actually went on to be in, he certainly is in Cards on the Table, which is also a book that Poirot is featured in, as well as Ariadne Oliver and Colonel Race. It's kind of like a super band.
I know, they like all get together as the Avengers. It's really fun.
Yeah. But then Toward Zero and Murder is Easy are not Poirot books.
They're
just
course.
Superintendent Battle books. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So he's just in, it's just Battle.
They're just Battle.
So in a way, there actually is like a little minor collection of Battle books, even though he's such a non-present, but that's very intentional on Christie's part. I actually quite like him. I think there's a lightness of touch in Battle as a detective character that's unusual in Golden Age Mysteries and unusual in Christie. And I appreciate him, I think, among his more bombastic compatriots, especially Poirot. But even Miss Marple, she herself isn't bombastic, but she's such a larger-than-life presence. I like the fact that we have Battle within the Christieverse.
I agree. I really like Battle. I like how she describes him. I like the idea that still waters run deep. I think that really comes across in battle more so than probably any other detective that she has.
Yeah.
And he also provides a great contrast to Jap, who is like, I think can be quite annoying, and like funny and fun and a little bit silly. And battle obviously doesn't have that quality, but he does do like a raised eyebrow very well. So I think she imbues him with a lot of like very British characteristics and actually gives him a really dry humor that I think her humor is often overlooked, but in general. But I think he occasionally has some moments where he just says something and you can just hear him saying it under his breath. I like battle as well very much.
Yeah, he's I think that the humor also in Christie, that's one of the other answers as to why does Christie endure as much as she does. And it's something that if you only know Christie by way of adaptations, mm-hmm. which many people do, and which is fine. I'm not saying that that's an illegitimate way to encounter Christie. But I think sometimes the humor in the books is elided by the adaptations just because there's not as much of a place for them on the screen as opposed to on the page. But Christie is pretty consistently funny.
Mm-hmm.
That was something else also that I was inspired by when I wrote my mystery, because I wanted it to have a lot of humor. And you know, it's why I think Rian Johnson with Glass Onion and Knives Out, I mean, he is really so the true inheritor of Agatha Christie. And he is very vocal about that, that, you know, that he's inspired directly by Christie with these movies. And that's what Christie was doing. I mean, I think people sometimes also, especially if they only know the David Suchet series, which again was how I got to my podcast with Catherine. So I love the Suchet series, but if you only know the Suchet series, then you think that Christie is set in the mid-30s and is, you know, is basically frozen in time. And you might think that if you only watch the Marples, any of the Marple series as well, because they too are pretty much frozen in time. And that's because of, you know, production values basically, and not wanting to have to reset a series and giving it a sort of consistent look and feel. But Christie was always writing for her own present. And that very much changed because she was writing for 50 years.
Yeah.
So that too, I think, and that I think is something that we can get from The Secret of Chimneys almost on an anthropological level. It's pretty fascinating to think, okay, this was a book that was, if not popular, you know, that did well in the 20s. And this is what people liked to read. It might not have been how people actually acted, I hope not. but that's just quite a different thing from what Christie would write as she was doing her puzzle mysteries in the 30s. And then, you know, something like Endless Night, which is very much of its time in the late 60s and has a sort of almost horror movie-ish darkness to it. So that too, I think, is just what makes the comparison, the compare and contrast exercise fascinating, because the books are just so different as to tone and setting as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, we've talked a little, you talked about a bit about battle, and, you know, one of the other characters that stands out to me in this book is Virginia Rebel. And as I've said previously, I don't like,
because you love her, right?
I am not a fan, not a huge fan. But, you know, what I find frustrating about a character like Virginia, which is the same frustration I have with Tuppence, the same frustration I have with Anne Bedingfeld, is the idea of like pluckiness is essentially a characteristic that only exists within the male gaze. Like, people aren't plucky. Women aren't plucky. Like, they only exist in pluckiness in that kind of like, some to be looking at them. And it's the same with like demureness or hysteria. Like, they're similar qualities to me. And so for that reason, those characters never land for me as grounded, because the actions they take have nothing to do with how a real person would act. And like, just that, you know, that really the first time we meet Virginia Revel and she gets blackmailed and she like enjoys the experience so much that she decides to just go along with it. Like, that for me was the moment where I was like, my suspension of disbelief no longer, like, I've reached my limit for like how I can enjoy this in suspending my disbelief, because I love Madcap, but like it went beyond that to the point where I was like, this isn't even fun. It doesn't make sense to me anymore. Did you have that experience at all? Cause when you talked about the book in your podcast, I think Catherine had a similar perspective. You were a little bit more generous with your perspective.
Yeah, I do agree with it. I think that if suspension of disbelief has to go to character in addition to plot.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really tough pill to swallow as a reader. And usually it doesn't with Christie. And
yes,
on,
exactly.
on that first podcast episode, because I also listened to that in preparation mm-hmm. to remember what we said.
What did I say?
It's been so many years. We did a lot of comparing it to The Man in the Brown Suit because we had just read The Man in the Brown Suit since we were going in publication order. And I think that Anne Bedingfeld in The Man in the Brown Suit, I'm sure she too annoys you because she also does. Is a very plucky character. But, and I believe Catherine felt the same way about this. I find Anne Bedingfeld so much more convincing solely because she's the narrator.
Yeah.
So we at least have this, and Christie, by the way, almost never did that. She only has two first-person female narrators, mm-hmm. Anne Bedingfeld in The Man in the Brown Suit and Amy Leather in Murder in Mesopotamia.
That's right.
Both are two of my favorite narrative voices, actually, in the entire canon. But I think that Anne Bedingfeld is so much more convincing because we're inside of her head from the start of the book. And even though you can still be irritated by her, I think it's easier to believe her for that reason.
Yeah.
And I think some of the other, you know, I don't hate Tommy and Tuppence as much as you do. Before I did the podcast, I did.
Okay.
I definitely was like, oh, the Tommy and Tuppences. But then as I was reading them more closely, I mean, the fact that they age pretty much with Christie is interesting. And I think there's some interesting push and pull going on with Christie's personal life and her depictions of Tommy and Tuppence through the years. And we just don't get that with any of the other characters.
That's interesting.
But I completely understand being annoyed by Anne Bedingfeld and even by Emily Trefusis in The Sitterford Mystery and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Virginia Revel is one of the least convincing. And I agree with you. I mean, it's that blackmail thing. What does that even mean to enjoy the experience of being blackmailed? How? Like, what?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's so absurd. And there's nothing that grounds it because we barely know her. So we don't know her to be like an adventure taker or someone who's self-destructive or there's just nothing there to kind of ground what she's doing in any history of the character. And I suppose you either buy it or you don't. And I just that scene for me, I was like, oh God, you know, you get to because you speak about this in your podcast as well. There's a lot of prologue in this book. The first 50 or so pages, you're just hearing about backstory and you haven't even gotten to Chimneys yet. And so you get through to that point and then this is kind of the big scene that leads towards Chimneys. And I was like, oh my God.
Nope, I'm out.
I'm out.
I'm out.
I'm out. And the funny thing of course was I have of course read this book before and then I read it again because we had a podcast planned and then it was canceled because I think did my family get COVID? Something happened. And so then I had to read it again before the podcast just, cause I wanted to make sure I had all the information. And I just thought this is a self-destructive behavior to have to read this three times. But,
I'm so sorry that you had to read it two times. By the way, the first time it was rescheduled, our conversation, cause I was going to read it just before I hadn't read it yet.
I only
had to reread it, once.
That was very smart.
I think that's an important point. I'm glad you brought that up. The fact that this book takes a long time, to get off the ground.
Yeah.
We don't get to Chimneys until about page 100 and it's a 300-ish page book.
Right.
That's ridiculous. And Christie almost always had fantastic beginnings, fantastic hooks for her books. It's very, very unusual for a book of hers to begin badly. If I'm being super generous, I will say I think the second half of The Secret of Chimneys is much better than the first half. It gets going. It's like a ball rolling down a hill. You get some momentum going. Yeah. So you're like, okay, I'm at least with you now. But those first 50 to 100 pages are really not good. And the only other book that I think where I had a similar experience is They Came to Baghdad. And that plucky heroine, Victoria Jones, similar enough to Virginia Revel that I always get them mixed up in my head. I believe her name is Victoria Jones.
I think you're right.
Those two, I think, are by far my least favorite of the plucky heroines. There's Hillary Craven in Destination Unknown, who's actually one of my favorites because the hook for Destination Unknown in the beginning is quite good and quite gripping. And I think sympathetic, but yeah, here you're just like, you know, you're in Africa. There's some obnoxious guys basically, who are bros.
They're like colonial bros.
Colonial bros. That's exactly who they are. I wasn't captivated by them. I wasn't captivated by Virginia Revel. And spoiler, you know, Anthony Cade and Virginia Revel are our two romantic leads who we're supposed to, you know, be really invested in. And that never happened. And that's a big problem. And I think all of the other characters who are populating chimneys are cartoony at best.
Yeah.
And usually with Christie, the plot is humming along quite nicely. And even if it's not, she's doing something interesting with the characterization or the setting of the book. And here she's not. The other insight I think that I had when I read this that I didn't have at the time, now being at the end of the whole canon, is that I think Christie tends to be on her shakiest ground when she sets a book in England that is populated by a lot of non-English people.
Yes. So true.
And that actually doesn't happen very often, because what she often does is she has her travelogue books, right? So, you know, Death on the Nile, Murder in Mesopotamia, et cetera, et cetera. And when her English characters are on the shifting sands of, you know, staying in a hotel or being on a boat going down the Nile or whatever, it's okay. And she'll still have a bunch of cringeworthy moments of depiction stuck in their time, which, to be clear, I'm not judging her for. I just think they have to be acknowledged and dealt with
as a reader.
Those books end up acquitting themselves pretty well. There are very few books where, and then most books that are set in England only deal with white English people.
Right.
Of varying classes often, or, you know, they're often of the middle class actually, but this is a rare book that is set in England that has a lot of non-English characters. And the only other book that I can think of and compare it to is Hickory Dickory Dock, which we also ranked extremely low because it's one of the most difficult books to read, I think, from my 21st century perspective. I was wincing practically on every page, even though I think she was very well intentioned. She was trying to create a cast of characters of, you know, these multinational students who were coming from Africa and India and the Caribbean and who were graduate students and cultured. And she had the best of intentions, but it just does not come off very well. And they're very unconvincing and very cartoony.
They're very flat.
And I think we have the same thing here with like Boris, who is the Herzoslovakian servant who is compared to a dog multiple times, and just the paternalism, you know, with which he is described. And again, the anti-Semitism. There's a character named Herman Isaacstein who's almost never called by his proper name. And it's supposed to be so, so, so funny that they call him all of these different things, including nosy, I believe, at one point. It's just awful. So that, I think, is another reason why this book acquits itself a lot less successfully than many a Christie.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I also agree with what you said earlier, which is that the second half is an easier read and is more enjoyable than the first. And there are some things that, no matter whether I like the book or the plot or the characters or not, there are some things that Agatha Christie just does so well. For me, I love how she describes houses. I adore the way she describes certain rooms. And for me, that's like such a treat. And she does it really well in this book. She talks about chimneys. She talks, I think, at one point about like the way the light falls in a particular room. That's a really charming scene. I can always find something, because I do just like her style.
And her dialogue is always good. She's, and that's the reason why I'm actually going to do an episode on the podcast in which I reconsider Secret of Chimneys as well. So if you haven't gotten enough Secret of Chimneys, I'll be doing a Secret of Chimneys centered episode too. But I think it certainly deserves to be ranked higher than those later career Christies when she wasn't firing on all cylinders and the macro structure of the book suffered, and also the micro elements such as the dialogue, which in these early Christies, I mean, it is just like sparking, you know, like even though we might not be convinced by Virginia and Anthony as characters or care about their romance because they don't seem like people, their dialogue is spicy.
Yeah, they've got some banter, right?
Entertaining. Yeah, and she just she could do that so well. And yeah. I always appreciate that. And I just have to add, because you mentioned setting, one of my favorite moments in this book actually is that when we first come upon Chimneys, she has, you know, from her third person narrative perspective, she says something like, I don't have the passage in front of me, but she says something like, well, you know, Chimneys has been written up in historic registers and there are pictures of it everywhere. And basically, if you want to, you know, find out what Chimneys looks like, you can go look it up.
Yeah,
so I'm not going to describe it. So a description won't be necessary.
Yeah.
And but then through the course of the book, she does go on to describe specific rooms, and very much, I think, to give you a sense of place, quite effectively and quite concisely.
Yes.
Which is something that, you know, other authors don't do as well. You know, I love P.D. James, I love Daphne du Maurier, but sometimes you're reading those descriptive passages, about flowers in front of a house or the shape of a column, and you're like, could we get on with the mystery? I do too. I mean, it depends, you know,
it depends.
But it's almost a little bit Austen-like. I mean, Jane Austen also had she didn't want to spend a lot of time, I think, describing scenery.
Yeah.
You know, she had no patience for that.
Yeah.
But I think, Christie, you know, does actually set the story at Chimneys extremely well. Mm. And also, fun fact, by the way, you know that there is a theatrical adaptation of this book that she wrote. She wrote it probably in the late 20s, and it was supposed to be staged in the early 30s, and it never made it to the stage. And it was sort of discovered or rediscovered in the late or really the early 21st century, and first put on for the first time ever, I believe, in 2003 in Canada.
Oh, so right. Dr. Curran spoke about this. He went to go see it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. He did go to see it. Yeah. That's right. He has told me that story as well. Yeah. And I was very jealous of him. Like, God, I would have loved to go to the debut of an Agatha Christie play that's never, you know, seen a stage before. But, she changed the murder also a little bit in the play. But as far as I can tell, she was really just trying to streamline the novel because it's so overstuffed.
You would have to. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain stage adaptations of her novels in which she did change the murderer, or she would change certain things, such as And Then There Were None, An Appointment with Death. But this, to me, I took a quick look at the play script before coming on this episode because I wanted to know for myself. It really just looks like she was trying to streamline things.
Okay.
So I'm not sure. I think if you didn't love Chimneys the book, I don't know if you need to run out and see the Secret of Chimneys, theatrical adaptation.
Enough. But I love, just going back quickly to what you said about how she says, like, there's so much about Chimneys, I don't need to explain it to you. That's something that she does quite a lot with more technical stuff, I've noticed, where she'll go, here the conversation became technical. And that's her way of saying, like, I'm not going to tell you what they said because it would be way too much for me to research. Every time it happens, and it's like quite frequent, they always make me giggle a little bit. It's usually like forensics or something to do with guns or something she doesn't want to like get pinned on her, I guess, for not knowing.
And she gives you the vital information.
Right.
She always plays fair, right? She gives you the vital information, but she's not going to bore you with technicalities because she always has an eye out for entertainment and for keeping those pages turning, which with some exceptions, such as the first 100 pages of this book, she usually does quite well.
Absolutely agree. So would you say that if you were perhaps, I don't know, like a casual Agatha Christie fan, is this a book that you'd recommend people read?
No.
Okay. Agree. Strong agree. Moving on from that. And how are you?
Can I qualify that answer, though?
Go ahead.
I it's a hard no, only because there are so many other books that I would recommend before it. I think if you have read all the other books and you haven't read The Secret of Chimneys at that point, yes, 100%. Like, a completist should absolutely read The Secret of Chimneys. And there are a couple of books that might be even more painful to read other than The Secret of Chimneys. So in that case, I would recommend, but it's just because there's such an abundance, an embarrassment of riches when it comes to Christie, that you don't have to go to The Secret of Chimneys. You can pick up so many other titles.
I agree. And in terms of the podcast, you've now kind of done the last book. How are you planning? Are you planning to keep going? What's the agenda with All About Agatha?
I'm definitely planning on continuing with the podcast. Yeah. It's been such a joy to build up a community of listeners. And I think moving forward, I'm going to be doing episodes revisiting certain titles, such as revisiting The Secret of Chimneys, for example. I'm not going to do that with that many titles. I think a little bit of that goes a long way.
Yeah.
But there are always other authors to interview, and I think just other aspects of Agatha Christie to examine, as you well know.
I sure do.
It's very easy, I think, to do a podcast. Not easy, but I think it's feasible to do a podcast about Agatha Christie that isn't merely ranking all of her books.
Yeah.
So in some ways, Rebecca, I mean, I'm edging in on your territory because now I'm becoming just a free flowing, you know, freestyle Agatha Christie podcast,
yeah,
without the backbone of this rankings project. But there is, as we said at the start of this conversation, I'm surprised there aren't more of us. I'm sure there will be more of us. And I welcome,
yeah,
more of us, because I think, yeah, it's infinite the amount of chatter that we can create about Agatha Christie. So just to give you one example, I'm going to do an episode in the next couple of months I'm very excited about that will actually be ranking the murderers. So talking about the murderers in Christie books as opposed to the books themselves. Because there are some books that don't acquit themselves as well as puzzles overall that have a fantastically characterized murderer.
Yes.
And vice versa. There are, you know, there are other books where the murderer is not so great, even though we might have ranked the book fairly high for other reasons.
Wow.
And that's something
that's
such
a great idea. I love that.
Yeah, that people have responded to. So just, you know, again, it's not going to be hard for me to babble on and on and on ad infinitum about Agatha Christie, as you could probably tell from this very conversation.
but I'm exactly the same way. I mean, I basically was just like, can I make a podcast where I just talk to people about Agatha Christie like endlessly? And it turns out that there's a lot of people willing to do that with me. So it's, yeah, been an absolute joy to get to do, yeah, and to hear so many different perspectives. And it sounds like we've talked to like a fair few bit of the same people, because I think it's, I wouldn't say it's a small universe, but it's certainly there's a kind of a top tier of experts who, you know, you can go to, and people who really love her work and are experts in her work. And I think that's what's been so nice, is that sometimes you approach a subject and people who are experts are kind of, there's like a joylessness in the expertise.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the case with Agatha Christie. I have found people who are experts in her work, who have been studying her for decades, still just love reading her books. And that,
yep,
is wonderful.
It starts with a love of Christie, and usually a longstanding love from, if not childhood, early adulthood. And I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
I've never thought about it that way, but it's true. The world of academia surrounding Agatha Christie is suffused with joy.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
And that's a rare thing.
And opinions. And we sat here and talked about a book neither of us really liked that much, with a lot of fun and a lot of joy in our hearts. At least there was in mine.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that's really
great. A lot of affection. Yeah.
A
right?
lot of affection. Absolutely. Yeah. For whatever she wrote that I don't like, I mean, A, I'm still going to read it. And B, there's always something to find that I do like. And C, it's okay to not like something and still kind of love her work overall. As you say, that she produced so much that's possible. It's really not possible with that many writers. But she has given us the gift of allowing us to not like her stuff.
Thanks, Agatha.
So thank you so much for being here, Kemper. I think, this is a great place to say goodbye. Would you like to be found by the people? And if so, where can they find you?
So, people can find the podcast, mm-hmm, wherever they listen to podcasts. Just search for All About Agatha. It's technically called All About Agatha with Christie in parentheses.
Uh-huh.
Just so if people put in Agatha Christie, that it should also, you should also be able to find the podcast.
Great.
It'll
SEO
probably
work.
Be right, yeah, next to your podcast.
Yeah.
So you can find the podcast there. And then you can find the podcast on Twitter,
yep,
at All About the Dame. And we're also on Instagram at all about Agatha. And I always encourage people just to get in touch with me via email, because I find that those are the interactions that are the most meaningful, because you can communicate in longer than, you know, chunks of text or pictures.
Yeah.
So my email address is allaboutthedame@gmail.com. If anyone would like to get in touch, please do. Because I love talking about Agatha Christie with anyone and everyone.
Fantastic. And we will have all that information in the episode notes, as well as links to the podcast, of course, and to the specific episode where you talk about The Secret of Chimneys with Catherine. And we'll eventually be putting in the link for your book when it comes out. So we're excited for that. And thank you again for being here. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been a joy.
Thanks, Kemper. Have a great day. Thank you to our producer, Kate Crichel, and our sound engineer, Winter Robinson. If you want to support this podcast, you can follow us on Instagram at TNMurder. You can rate and review us on iTunes, and you can tell all your friends and even strangers to follow us on your podcast platform of choice. In 2 weeks, you bring the tea and we'll bring the murder with The Body in the Library. You can rent it from your local library, buy from your local independent bookseller, or if you need to buy online, we recommend bookshop.org, which supports independent bookstores with every purchase. A link for next week's book can be found in the episode notes. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Tea and Murder. We hope you had a bracing dose of both.